Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. In this episode, I'm joined by my new friend, Steph Towers, for a fantastic, passionate, wide-ranging conversation about the kind of leadership we need right now. Steph brings a people-first lens to agriculture that's both practical and quietly radical. We talk about how real leadership often isn't something you chase, it's something you step into because the work needs doing. We explore the habits that make that possible, lifelong learning, the courage to say we don't know yet, and the ability to hold uncertainty without trying to control it. A big thread running through this conversation is trust. Steph named something I think a lot of leaders are still missing. In a world where producers and the public are getting their information from TikTok, X, Instagram, some even Facebook, trust doesn't come from sounding confident. It comes from being clear, from being transparent about what you know, what you don't, and what you're going to do next. Steph also shares a vivid example from the tariff-era anxiety now shaping export-dependent sectors, and why curiosity and empathy can de-escalate fear faster than any communication strategy ever will. We get into emotion as a leadership asset, not a liability, and how the culture of grin it and bear it is colliding with a growing necessary openness about mental health in agriculture. If you care about the future of agri-food leadership in Canada, or if you just want to watch a future prime minister come into being, you got to learn about my friend Steph Towers and the phenomenal work that she's doing. Hi, Steph Towers. Welcome to the Future Herd.
Hi, it's great to be here. I am so excited to have a conversation with you about the future herd, the future of agriculture.
Now, I will state from a process perspective that when we announced this on LinkedIn, you were one of the first people to kind of connect with me. And I was so grateful because as soon as you did, I was like, this is exactly the kind of person I want to be talking to. So thank you very much for accepting my invitation. And I love starting our chats with, what does the future mean to you?
Ooh, wow. We're just going to get right in there and pull it out. So for me, I've grown up in ag. I've been in and around different sectors for my entire life. And the future for me is all about blending those past traditions with all of the technology and all the information that's coming forward. But I think when you really get down to it, the future of agriculture for me is in people.
Right on. And from that people perspective, how did you become a leader so to project so easily and so effortlessly? I'm not a fan of the phrase natural born leaders. I don't think such things exist. But you're close in the sense that you've kind of been playing with leadership since you've been playing. So give me some insight as to how that happened.
Wow, that's huge praise. I'm not sure that I even would consider myself a leader in traditional metrics. I think for me, it's about trying to make a difference. It's seeing something that you're passionate about and that you feel strongly about and wanting to be part of change and change for the better, not just for yourself, but for those around you and for the industry as a whole. Throughout my life, I have taken on leadership positions, not necessarily on purpose, but because someone needed to step up and do the work. And that has been really empowering. And I think to the commitment to lifelong learning. I'm a big believer that you have to be learning something new every day. It's part of why we're here. And it is so rewarding to continually learn and to be able to put that into practice. But at the heart of it, it just comes back to wanting better for myself, my family, and the people around me.
Preach, sister. And I say this because as I suspect, learning is my through line as well.
Yes.
It's presently why I'm waking up so excited and happy because I'm currently in the midst of a big learning project. But I have to ask, because A, I don't think I was praising you when I called out your extensive experience as a leader. It's really, from my perspective, showing respect. But I'm curious, like, who were your influences? Were your parents kind of leaders themselves? Were there people in your community that you looked up to and you're like, wow, they're cool, I want to do that too? Because you take for granted the idea that if there's a problem, someone's got to solve it. Or we need people to be focusing on impact and bringing people together. And to your point, bringing people together. So before we get into the real nuts and bolts of our current sector, what were those influences? Who inspired you when you were younger to be as courageous as you are?
So I grew up in a small farming community. We had hogs, so fair to finish. My dad was wildly influential in my life. He and my grandparents, as well as my aunts and uncles, were very involved in community. So whether that was local hockey, local baseball, if there was something that we were involved in as kids, and even if it was something we weren't involved in, but they needed someone to step up and coach or be the trainer or fill that spot so that kids could play, my dad was it. He was the president of the Minor Ball Association, and both my brother and I, on multiple occasions as teenagers, were voluntold that we would be coaching because he needed coaches to be able to run that team. But there were 15, 20 kids depending on somebody coaching, and the result was going to be that the teams would fold. So I think from a young age, we were just brought up to believe that community is incredibly important and collaboration is incredibly important, and that when you treat the people around you with respect and invest your time and your talents, that comes back, and it comes back tenfold in the community that you live in, the relationships that you build, and, you know, who you are as a person.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And it helps give me the larger context as to where your passion, your infectious energy comes from. But let me ask you a potentially controversial question, because when you talked about people-centric agriculture, you sort of inferred that it's something we need. It's something that hasn't always been there. But you also just described your sense of community in which that's a constant, right? That's something that is just you're voluntold to be part of. What happened? Because I think there's a story there. I think there's a disconnect where we did used to have vibrant communities where that responsibility to help each other out was part of the social fabric. But to your point, it's not the language we're always using. It's not the culture that we're always emphasizing. So before we get into how to bring that back, I'm curious, Steph, from your perspective, how did that happen? Where did we make a wrong turn there?
Wow.
Deep real so early on these
we
episodes.
We go deep really fast here. So it's a fantastic question, and I don't know that there's a single answer to it, because I think a lot of that fabric does still exist. You see it in rural communities. If there's a barn fire, neighbors stepping up and going to get cattle and making sure everybody's taken care of. You see it if there's a fundraiser for someone that's sick in the community. So I think we still do have that foundational sense of community, but I think that we've moved away from it. There's so many relationships now that are online, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's different. It's thinking that you're following someone and you have that relationship with them, but it's really one-sided. And so I think that as we have shrunk in the agricultural community, we're losing farms every day for consolidation reasons and all sorts of things. We're so focused on efficiencies and outputs that we have maybe, not all the time, but we have lost the focus on people first. We're concerned with margins, and we have to be, right? Farming is a business, and it's critically important to be able to stay afloat, to be focused on margins and throughput and output. But when we focus on that at the expense of our relationships, it brings us down. And I think that's that kind of merging technology and things changing so much more rapidly than they used to. That's all at the center of it, where the ballpark and church and community dinners, those used to be the places that you got your information. Now you click on to Instagram or Facebook and you pull up your local community page and you've got everything right at your fingertips without ever having to leave the house. And so this focus on efficiencies and not taking the hour to go to the community barbecue, I think that it is detrimental. And it's not on purpose. And it's not necessarily something that we realize we've been doing. But when you look back, we've definitely lost some of that interconnectedness.
Well, and I think not only is that a brilliant insight, but it speaks to the perspective that leaders can have to address these problems. Because, you know, if I can try to express it as a metaphor, on the one hand, I think you accurately described that at the grassroots, that spirit is still there. It's still active. There still is a real strong commitment to community. But when you scale the institutions up, you lose some of those circuits. So we maintain the circuits around sustainable business practices. We maintain some of the circuits around, say, sharing agronomy knowledge or sharing, you know, tractor knowledge. But people knowledge we've lost, and that social knowledge we've lost. So as a leader, how do we do that? How do we take those circuits that are still active in the community and reintegrate them into our institutions? Because I'm hypothesizing that part of what you're trying to do as a leader, right, is sort of see it from both angles. You grew up in the grassroots and you know the value that's there, but you're also identifying in the institutions that there's a gap, there's something missing here that we need to reintegrate and extend. And am I grokking you? Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, you summarized it far more eloquently than I could. Absolutely.
So what are your thoughts on execution, right? And obviously it's not something one single leader can do. We're talking about culture, right? It takes many hands to lighten the load. But tell me more as to how you've approached this problem and how you're trying to communicate this to other leaders. Because to me, it's self-evident. To me, I'm like, yeah, preach. But I suspect not everyone else is as open to these ideas, or in their defense, they just can't translate how obvious this is, the way that bottom line, for example, is an obvious sure. consideration for people to keep in mind.
For sure. So for me, it is approaching everything as people first leadership. It's all about empowering people to be their best selves, to be able to show up, to contribute, to bring ideas forward that we wouldn't necessarily have if we just act as our management team alone. So traditionally, leadership has been about control, especially within the agricultural community. We were looking to academia. We were looking to our commodity boards. We were looking to the government for the information on what we needed to do next. So that leadership model was really rooted in control and being able to deliver a confident message. So you were the only source of information, or maybe one of two sources of information, that farmers and community had. So it was really important to be very clear on your messaging, be very concise and confident, right? Even if that message was maybe missing a few, we're changing a lot slower. So the rate of change, the market swings, all of those things, if you look back 30, 40 years, were at such a slower pace that it was easy for leadership to thrive with a control mentality. Now, that's wildly different. Mm-hmm. People aren't relying on information sessions from their commodity boards. They're not relying on the news releases that come out 3 months late by the government. They're going to social media. They're going to TikTok. They're going to X. They're going to Instagram. They're going to Facebook. And so they already have opinions on what's going on. And so when you go into a meeting and people have questions, if that leadership model is control, and that narrative doesn't match the information that people have already accessed, and there's no balance, there's no give and take, it erodes trust really fast. People aren't looking for confidence anymore. They're looking for clarity. They want to understand what decisions are being made, why. They're looking for transparency. They're looking for their leaders to be that beacon of light through that huge mass of information that they've collected. They want their leadership to say, hey, this is what's going on. This is what we know now. This is where we're at. It's okay to not know the things that we don't know. And it is definitely okay to communicate that to your base, to the people that are looking to you for answers. there's a lot more credibility in transparency and clarity than there is in control or having a perfectly polished narrative.
Absolutely brilliant. You're knocking every one of these out of the park. It's truly impressive. So I gotta now throw the real hardball pitch, and I'll do it in a way that I'll give you a fork in the road so you can hedge yourself accordingly. I think the trust issue, as you just outlined it, is the issue fundamentally, that everything else flows from there. I do want to talk policy, but before our episode here is done, but I want you to double down on that trust piece. And the fork in the road is, I'd love to hear some examples that you think demonstrate this new model of leadership that earns trust in the media environment that you describe. And alternatively, if you want to go there, what are the leadership practices that are so ludicrously outdated that they are hurting the leadership of those organizations because they're trying to control something they can't control and consequently are losing trust by the bucket load? Again, I don't want you to get into trouble, but I think you've hit the crux of the matter when it comes to the crisis of leadership in our sector, that your view, as brilliant as it is, not as widely held as it should be.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, let's do it. Okay. So one of the best examples that I have seen recently was an organization that when Trump came into power, there were a lot of discussions on tariffs and what that means for our predominantly export market. And this commodity group had their CEO hold a press conference and say, listen, we don't know how this is going to affect us. We don't know when it's coming in. What we do know is that we are a really strong industry. What we do know is that we have really great senior staff. What we do know is that we are going to fight to protect this industry and to ensure that Canada remains a global leader in the export for this commodity. And it did amazing things. Their membership base was behind them. There was a confidence there. You could see the unrest in the room had dissipated, right? Because people felt seen. They felt heard. They felt like they mattered and that this organization was really listening to their concerns. And there were some follow-up questions that were pretty aggressive. And this CEO was able to redirect and just say, I hear you. Can you tell me more about that? And just leading with that curiosity about why there's a problem. If your membership base or your consumers, whatever you're dealing with, or if it's on the family farm, you know, your next generation, if they're coming to you and they're mad, do you know why? Because you probably don't. That is one thing that I think is really undervalued as you talk about leadership characteristics. Curiosity. Mm-hmm. Curiosity is one of the most underrated leadership skill, and you can learn it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be born with it. You can absolutely learn it. It's that step back, pause for 2 or 3 seconds and say, what do you mean by that? And after asking that a few times, you got down to it. And this particular question that was very aggressive got down to this young farmer was concerned about the debt load he had taken on. He wasn't sure if borders were going to be shut down. He wasn't sure he's going to be able to make payments. And that CEO said, I really empathize with that. We have some loan agreements with banks. Let me get you in touch with some people. And just that understanding of where that frustration was coming from completely disarmed that room. So it was just something that was unbelievably well done. And the really interesting part about it was he didn't have any answers for them.
Yeah. And it really brings to the foreground an element of leadership that I think many people take for granted, but you just demonstrated is kind of central to the trust exercise, which is emotion. And I would argue that the agri-food sector, more than any other industry, emotion is part of it. Farmers are very emotional about their work. Food processors, entrepreneurs are very emotional about their work. And whether it's decision-making or policy, they often become emotional. What role does that emotion play? Like, because on the one hand, you talked about emotional composure, emotional literacy, emotional vulnerability, right? Like, there's different layers to that. but it's also evoking a model of leadership that acknowledges uncertainty, that acknowledges things you can't control. Again, we're really getting into the weeds here, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts as someone who, you know, to your earlier mark, you've seen multiple generations of leadership, both in terms of people you've collaborated with, but also in terms of the people that you've grown up watching. How is our understanding of emotion and leadership changing? And are we at a point where we can talk about it? The way you talked about some of the skills that one can acquire when one aspires to be a better leader.
I think we're getting there. I really do. I think that there is movement towards accepting all of those emotional components as fundamental to connecting with people. So having emotional intelligence, being able to read someone, being able to understand, oh, this person's behavior's off from a couple days ago or a couple weeks ago, or this person's work is declining, and being able to step back and say, okay, this isn't typical of them. What's actually going on here? You know, that I think we are approaching a place where we can talk about it more. I think that with the movement towards more acknowledgement of mental health in agriculture, that we're slowly seeing an acceptance of looking at things differently and not just put your head down and grin and bear it because there's work to do. It's hard though, because those are foundations that agriculture is really built on. That pull your bootstraps up and just get it done. So it's going to take time, and it's going to take people who are really invested in empowering people and leading with compassion, because it does so much for your company culture and it does so much for the members of your team to be able to have them comfortable to ask hard questions, comfortable to voice their opinions, and comfortable to say, hey, I'm not okay. And those things ultimately will positively affect your bottom line.
Well, and let's use that as a way to kind of tie in the meeting spaces and the media that kind of create the culture of agriculture. Because on the one hand, you know, we're having this conversation in early March, and this is, you know, the winter is often the season of ag events, right? When people really come together. And I think that's part of how the mental health issues have been normalized and destigmatized, is because at these events, I think, A, there's a lot of opportunity to talk about these issues, but when you're hanging out together, it's easier to be, are you okay? And to have that conversation. But the other side of this, of course, is media and the fact that people are in their tractor, you know, in their barn, using social media to connect with other people, to share knowledge with other people. I do want to talk about that in the larger context of leadership, but I want to start with the mental health side. To what extent can our events and can our media provide the kind of emotional, the kind of community support that we started our conversation with, right? That we used to live in this world, and many of us still do, where the community took care of each other. How is media, how is the internet, how are our events rising to that challenge or failing to do so, right? Because I am the kind of person who sees the through line between our mental health, our sense of well-being, and the culture that makes us say, hey, yeah, I'm a farmer and I'm proud. And it strikes me that our events and media help make that happen. I can't ask this question to most of the guests who'd come on this show, but Steph, I think that you've been thinking about these topics in a way that could, again, give you an opportunity to demonstrate your brilliance.
So to lead off, I am going to say I am in no way a mental health expert whatsoever, but I'm really fortunate to be very close friends with a number of people who are. And we have seen such great strides in Canada over the last 5 years on having multiple avenues for farmers to be able to reach out. We have some brilliant programming on teaching on the ground staff, so sales staff that's in and out of farms, and identifying some signs, on the farm sales staff to identify signs that someone's not okay. So does the barn look messier? Is the tractor not taken care of? And teaching them ways to approach these issues and not actually just brush it under the rug. So I think there's an amazing education element that is popping up at a ton of different meetings, a ton of different organizations. And there's also legitimate support as well. So whether it's in the form of therapy that you can access, whether it's the form of a crisis line or something like meditation apps that you can use while you're in the field or in the barn. So I think that we have made some really good strides in integrating that into our meeting spaces and working to destigmatize mental health in general. There's still a lot of work to be done, but man, we have some phenomenal organizations in Canada that help with that. Yeah.
Right on. And I appreciate that, A, you're not only game to come on a crazy podcast like this, but you're able to handle the crazy conversational twists and turns.
All good.
My,
I love it.
Autistic ADHD brain takes us on. Because I wanted to talk to you about events in particular, because I hypothesized that who we look to as leaders is almost, at least historically, has been a direct reflection as to how our events are constructed. Like, who has charisma? Who has the best speaking skills? Who knows the right people in the room? You know, I've been going to events long enough to realize that that's where politics happens, right? That's where, you know, power happens, because that's where people connect and trust and see with each other. So I would love to hear your thoughts on the role that events play, both in facilitating the practice of leadership, but I think more importantly, how could we change our events to get more and newer and different leaders who will help bring different perspectives, right? Will help bring new, vibrant energy. Because while I would love to believe, Steph, that there are a million others like you, you are an exception to the rule, and clearly your parents were phenomenal leaders unto themselves. But how do we get more people like us playing the game and having fun? And what role do you think events play in facilitating that?
Oh, so this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. I think engagement is something that I am unbelievably passionate about. Because I think, unfortunately, for a lot of organizations, not just within Ag, we take disengagement and we turn it into acceptance, right? You have a meeting and you only have a few people show up and it says, oh, everybody must be happy. Are they happy or are they disengaged? Because those are two very different things, right? So for me, meetings have to provide something of value. And you'll see that with different leadership styles. So if you have a leader who is still operating under the control model, trying to control the narrative, operating in a way that's comes from a form of authoritarian style of leadership, it won't be very interactive. It's going to be a lot of being talked to. The information is probably great, not saying that at all, but there will be very limited opportunity for dialogue. There will be very limited opportunity for engagement and for providing feedback to people or for building skills. So the best events that I have seen come from leaders who really value feedback, where there are open question periods, there are roundtable discussions with senior staff or board members, there are ample opportunities for conversation to happen amongst participants. It's not just a classroom style, you're there for 6 hours and okay, see you later. I am a firm believer that some of the best conversations happen in the hallways.
Mm-hmm.
So we need the meetings to provide the information, but we also need the meetings to provide the space for that reflection, that conversation, and that feedback to occur. Because the best meetings create conversations that last. So it's all going back to that leadership style of collaboration and curiosity and really valuing the input from your attendees instead of seeing it as, well, this is an information gathering event.
Right on. And this is where I get to do the aspirational part of the podcast and say, maybe one day we'll have an opportunity to do some kind of future herd leadership event where we do an event configuration. That's completely original. But back to the main subject, I personally think that food at any ag-related event needs to be so spectacular that people are like, oh my God, that was amazing. You said something very powerful there that really kind of triggered an emotional reaction to me, which was this idea that disengagement is complacency or that disengagement is satisfaction. And granted, it's one of those things obvious in hindsight, but when you said it, it's like I felt punched in the gut, because this is where I want to shift to policy. Because to me, one of the big complacent elements of disengagement within policy is this idea that Canadians don't know where their food comes from, and they never will. Versus, I see that as disengagement, and I see that as something we absolutely must address, because if we don't, our problems are only going to get worse. So allow me to use that as a hook to say, why do you think policy engagement is important? And as part of your travels, both within the leadership realm, but also perhaps engaging with folks who are new to leadership, who are new to policy, what are the prejudices? What are the obstacles? I'm someone who thinks that policy is like a playground where you can have lots of fun. What has your experience been, both yourself engaging the policy environment, but also trying to get other people to engage the policy environment? Because correct me if I'm wrong, it also suffers from a rate of disengagement.
Yeah. So policy is something I am very passionate about as well. And when it comes to saying people don't need know where their food comes from and we need to educate them, I'm going to push back on you a little bit on that one. Because I think this notion that we have created in ag of consumers need to be educated. Yes, but also no. So consumers aren't necessarily wrong. They're just not you. So challenge with having this mentality that it's we're going to tell them and we're going to educate them and show them where their food comes from, it really creates a point of friction, I would say, where we're positioning ourselves as someone superior to the people that are consuming the products that we produce. And I am unbelievably proud to be in agriculture. I think it is amazing the high quality food that we can produce in Canada and export to the world. We are a global treasure when it comes to agri-food and food production. But I think the thing we sometimes take for granted in agriculture is that we are also lucky to have people choose to put us on their plate.
So
it is.
I want to double down on this, and I want to flag that I do want to come back to policy engagement and getting people engaged in policy. But I think you're making a really, really smart point here, and I want you to kind of unpack it a little. Give me an example. Give me an example, because I think you're right. I think on the one hand, every industry likes to assume that it's superior and no one understands them, boo-hoo-hoo. And sometimes that leads to a false sense of we know and they don't. But is there an example, however vague, of something that the ag industry resents that the public is doing that, regardless of the public's motivation, that's cool. They can do that because we live in a free society, right? Because that is, I think, the larger context here in terms of we got to let people think for themselves.
We absolutely do. And I think for me, the one that seems to hit the hardest is people that are very passionate about their choice to not consume meat. That is always a big one. And what I would say is we are really fortunate to live where we do, that we have so much food choice. And I am never going to tell someone what they should or shouldn't put on their plate. Food is such an intimate decision and such an intimate relationship that all we can do is we can produce it, we can provide it, and appreciate those people that do choose to consume our products. That being said, there's a portion of people in the middle for general consumers that we'll call the movable middle. So more information may help them. They want to feel like they are doing something good. It goes back to that emotion,
yes,
right? They want to feel like the decisions that they're making for their plate and their family are the right decisions. They want to know that what you're doing isn't going to hurt them or their families. They want to know that they can support Canadian and feel good about that choice. It all comes back to, is the choice they're making for the food on their plate something they feel good about? And the movable middle are people that generally are curious. They want more information. They're looking for that information. they're open to having really constructive conversations.
See, I gotta interrupt just to throw another curveball at you, because I'm loving this, because I rarely get to talk to someone who has both ag literacy and media literacy, right? Because you understand both A, where the food comes from, but you also understand where people get their perceptions from and where their emotions from. And I love how you're evoking the middle, because it is a kind of swing vote, right? And that they are being informed and influenced by all these different factors. Because here's where I, as a farmer, react emotionally, and I suspect this is similar to others. While I absolutely support someone's right to never eat meat, I have a real problem when they say that beef is responsible for global warming, right? Or when they, like, because on the one hand, if it is about personal diet and nutrition, go nuts, eat whatever you want. But when it gets into the realm of policy, where they're not just talking about what they put on their plate, they're deciding, like, for example, here's another thing that I'll admit I'm still wrapping my head around. So what I'm about to say may be unformed, but I believe an important policy for farmers in Canada is increased rail infrastructure. Like, everything I'm seeing from grain farmers to, like, everybody across the country, we need to get our products to the market fast. And the bottleneck year after year is railways. But right now, here in Eastern Ontario, there's a revolt going on against high-speed rail. And everybody's going rail bad. And again, if these are different debates, fine. But the problem is, it's never just about what we eat. It's always about our worldview. It's always about our larger morals. And it always ties into policy as a whole. And that's where I think it's difficult for us, either as policy people or as human beings who have passionate issues about the job, to find that nuanced middle. So to bring it back to policy, how do we get more people seeing policy debates as something that are worth having, rather than, I think, when people get overwhelmed, they just go policy bad, rather than thinking that policy is wide enough for all sorts of views, and the goal is to find the middle, to find something that we can all kind of agree on. I'm rambling. I rarely have the opportunity with someone with your expertise and intelligence. So please, Steph, help me figure this stuff out.
So what I would say with policy is that agriculture in Canada, our numbers are shrinking, right? There's no way around it. And we don't have the luxury anymore of saying, oh, someone else will do it. We have to do it. And the thing about farmers and agri-food in general is that we're really good at telling our story to each other. We're great. We'll pat ourselves on the back all day in a meeting room of you and me and, oh, we did so great last year and we did all these things. But our narrative very rarely makes it outside of our silos. So agriculture in general still very much operates in silos. So you identify, oh, I'm a dairy producer, I'm a beef producer, I'm a grain farmer. We haven't made these steps. It's getting better, but we really haven't taken the steps we need to deconstruct those silos and work together as an agricultural industry. Like you said, trying to flesh out those commonalities of getting products to port faster. Our port infrastructure is crumbling, which is absolutely essential for our export markets. And figuring out the things that we do well together that we all need, and really advocating for government as one voice. That's not to say that you have to dismiss your concerns that are industry specific, but you can attack those one-on-one with meetings with MPs and MPPs and your local councillors. But if we could find commonality and collaboration on some of the key infrastructure messaging to government about helping to secure Canada, not only our food sovereignty, but to position ourselves as a global leader in food and agri-food export, that would be unbelievable. One of the biggest things I hear when I speak to MPs and MPPs is that there's so many messages coming from agriculture, sometimes conflicting, that it's a lot easier for them to throw up their hands and go, I don't know. Once you guys agree, come back to me, I guess. I'm not sure. Because they can't reasonably take any action when they have three voices for and three voices against. And so what happens is we get stuck in this situation where we're having trouble getting any policy put forward, where in agriculture, I think we can agree on some pretty fundamental things. Less red tape is essential for investment in processing and infrastructure. Better investment into ports, transportation, better investment into rural communities. There's so many things that are fundamental that we all agree on, that if we could align our voices and have that collaboration, we could really make some waves in terms of policy and communicating with government.
And I want to dig deeper into that point of a kind of unified voice, because that is something I'm hearing right across the board. And I think that to your point about the reducing numbers of farmers, it makes that even more important, right? That kind of coalition of the willing, for lack of a better phrase, can focus itself. And I want to return to that. But because you have such a high level of media literacy, I want to devil's advocate something I've been working through on my own. Because like yourself, I have often, when given the opportunity, told people we need better stories and we got to work on our storytelling skills. And, you know, narrative is really the force of power in the media environment we live in. But, you know, in the last few weeks, I've started coming to a slightly different conclusion that storytelling isn't enough. It's a battle. It's a battle of ideas. And whether we want it to be or not, you know, like Twitter of 2010 is dead and X of 2026 is a battle royale. And while on the one hand, we should be united in these battles, right, so that we're not fighting each other, there is. Like, it's no longer, here's my story, everybody listen. It's kind of like, elbows up, here's my story. I'm curious what you think of that. Are we still in a world in which the good stories rise? Or does there have to be some other element to make sure that the story is given attention before anyone has a chance to go, I like that story?
So I think it's a combination. I think that generally speaking, in the world that we live in, people are looking for the good news stories. They are looking to have their fears dealt with by, maybe it's a video of you in your cornfield or you with one of your cows or pigs or whatever it is. There is still very much that desire for good things, the desire for positivity, and the desire for people to feel like they're aligning with a community. So that's something I think we need to take into consideration when you're talking about, oh, the battles that are being fought on X and whatever that looks like. Social media has become people's social network. It has become their social fabric. And it is where trust is earned now. That social license we talk about, our ability to operate in agriculture and how critical that social license is, that social license is now earned online. It's not from academia anymore. It's not from our government. It's not from policymakers. It's from the influencer. Mm-hmm. It's from the person that you look at online and go, oh, they seem like me. Oh, I really like them. And you establish this connection with that person. And all of a sudden that person posts, oh, GMOs are bad. And 50,000 people on that post say, yep, nope, GMOs are bad. You start to internalize that as, oh, this person that I see every day who looks like me and has a family like me says they're bad. Oh, I guess they must be bad. And unfortunately, if there's no positive story to combat that, where are you going to go with your information? And you're right, it is a bit of an uphill battle, but we need to tell our stories. We need to continue to earn that social trust, and we need to do it in a way that can really execute on the things that we are doing well and really tell that story outside of our circles. And it's not just up to individual farmers. I think ag organizations have a huge part to play in that. I think academia needs to show up, not just saying the data says, but show it in practice, because they used to be the people that you would turn to and say, oh, that's what so-and-so says, that's what the research says. But now it's not the case that people stop believing the experts. It's that the experts stop showing up in the places where trust is built.
Yeah, and the experts forgot that emotion is how we make our decisions. The data can't speak for itself. The data is powerful, but the scientist needs to use emotion to explain why the data is important, why it's relevant. And this is where I think that the power of the people first concept is really important, because as you were taking my provocation around the battle place of ideas, you were kind of, you know, recentering the people-centric approach, which also to your example of the leader, right, who acknowledged that they didn't have the answers, you're not relinquishing leadership, but at the same time, you're earning trust and you're prioritizing the earning of trust, which is a people-first exercise that I think is indispensable. And to bring it back to this one voice idea, I think what you were just describing is in terms of the influencer and in terms of how we make our decisions on social media, right? And who we look to and trust. It strikes me that applies equally to what many of us call out and desire in terms of we want a united voice. I kind of feel that we're in this leadership void where everybody kind of knows what needs to happen. But you still need someone with the kind of chutzpah to stand up and go, I propose this as our one voice, right? And they may get modifications, they may get haters, but you still need people to do that. Like, you still need someone, to your point, you know, to say, hey, look, I think you guys are wrong about GMOs. You know, it's actually a little more complicated. And did you know that farmers have been breeding for thousands of years? Right? So that is still an act of leadership. How do you see that playing out? How do you see, whether it's young people, whether it's people who have the experience of decades, you know, how do we get people to demonstrate the vulnerability to not just have everyone looking around the room going, yeah, we agree, but one person say, yes, I'll stand up and take the risk.
So one of my favorite lines that I have ever heard came from a mentor of mine. And he said, indecision is still a decision. It's just a really shitty one. And I think that's the crossroads that we're at right now as we delve into these new leadership models and with everything going on south of the border. I think agriculture is positioned to be spectacular in Canada. Yes. I think there is so much opportunity and the appetite is there. The export markets are there. We're working with countries globally that we've never been able to work with before or haven't worked with in a really long time. The potential for us to unleash as an agri-food superpower is absolutely there. And I think now is the time. We have to have somebody step up and we have to really focus on coming together to ensure that we stay relevant. And I think the central part of that is going to be people. It's who are we bringing along with us? And this idea of making sure we're involving the next generation and ensuring that we, much like my dad did, show them that this is important. You have to be involved. You have to understand the commodity groups that represent you, the policy that's being shaped, even something as simple as, do you know what your local infrastructure is? If town council decides not to fix a bridge that you need to access your fields, are you going to be aware of it in time to go and protest at council and say, no, I need this bridge? Or are you going to be really surprised in the spring when that bridge is out?
See,
so there's...
Well, I got to interrupt because at the start of what you were saying, I was having this emotional reaction, which made me wonder, why am I believing Steph when she says this, when I don't believe other leaders when they say the exact same thing? But then you answered it because you're not saying, trust me because I'm Steph. You're saying, trust me because I am connected to a whole bunch of other people who are going to do this with me, right? And that is a completely different model of leadership than historically our institutions have had. And it inspires me to add a new feature of the podcast, which is, Steph, who are the leaders that you're currently looking at that are inspiring you? right? Because I get the sense that you are not the kind of sole hero on the quest trying to save Canada, that the enthusiasm and emotion that you just conveyed, which made me believe you instantly, is a consequence of you feeling that there are other people who have your back, right? Who are there equally committed and motivated. So not put you on the spot, but you got any shout outs of other people who our listeners should be paying attention to for the sole reason that you're paying attention to them?
So I have a ton of people that are wildly influential in my life that I turn to and look at both within Ag and outside of Ag. And I think maybe that's something we don't talk about enough, is looking outside of agriculture for things that we can bring into the industry that maybe are concepts in other industries that have been proven and ongoing for quite a while. So I actually, at a Grain Farmers of Ontario event, I met Hamza Khan, who is a very influential leadership guru, we'll call him. And something he said in that presentation really resonated with me. And it was that good leaders make themselves redundant. Mm-hmm. So they're so focused on empowering people and pushing people to be the best versions of themselves that they know they're going to put themselves out of a job. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's great. As 4 or 5 members of their team could step up at any time and do their job. And that's the mark of a really great leader. Within agriculture, I think Jennifer Wright from CARC is amazing with all of the work that organization is doing. 54% of people can't name a job outside of farmer. That's wild. And they are working so hard to show the potential that is here to try and not have those 100,000 job vacancies by 2030. I think that we have a phenomenal, one of the co-ops I'm part of, Suzanne from Gay Lee, is absolutely a fantastic example of someone who empowers the people around her to step up and do their job. I think that there are a number of CEOs across commodity groups and senior policy advisors that are fantastic. Yeah, there's so many people within our industry, but also outside, that we can learn so much from.
Right on. And that's such a fantastic attitude to have, which kind of leads to the next question. Although I do, for a process perspective, say, I lament that so much of Canada's approach to leadership is the tall poppy syndrome, where we get jealous of leaders and start, you know, hating them. I want to do the opposite here. I want to be us. We're boosting all the leaders, right? And giving them the gas. But you started off this talk really in expressing your joy of learning. And it kind of, you know, where you just gave that last answer, especially the idea that the leader needs to put themselves out of a job, that they need to empower the people around them so effectively that they can do an Irish goodbye and no one's going to notice because the organization will be in great hands. Towards that end, what are you currently learning? Like, what are the sorts of things that has you as a leader, but also you as an active learner, kind of excited to add to your repertoire of knowledge and skills?
So I'll start with what I'm currently doing. So currently I am taking the Ag Women in Ag, so Women in Ag from CARC. They've got a 10-week course it's a leadership course. So I'm doubling down on leadership skills, adding some more tools to the toolbox. And I am also working on getting my bilingual certification, because I think that as we have these conversations about collaboration, it is essential to be able to communicate in both of our official languages proficiently. I can do it now, but it's less than perfect. Luckily, my French counterparts have a good sense of humor and appreciate me at least giving it the old college try.
Right on.
But something that I am really passionate about and something that I have been working on now is an engagement piece to our offerings at Fresh Air Media. So I think that in order to get the collaboration that we're talking about and really having that united front as Canadian agriculture, we really need to put the work in to engage our primary producers. We need people at the front lines acknowledging that there are time constraints, that there are stress constraints, that there are different challenges that maybe are preventing them from being engaged. And we really need to work on creating a platform for communication that meets them where they're at.
I'd love for you to elaborate. I again, what I find so emotionally rewarding about our conversation today is you keep triggering these like reactions where I'm really inspired by kind of how you're approaching what I think both of us see as a set of opportunities, but if ignored, a set of growing problems. And I think the communication piece is central to that. So elaborate, please tell me more about, you know, both the kind of services that you're providing, but I think more to your point, the capabilities that you're trying to help the sector build.
Yeah. So I think what we're seeing across sectors is this really robust engagement around that early 20s. So coming out of maybe you went to college, maybe you went to university, maybe you've been home for a few years now, but you're really getting into it. So it's typically prior to being married, typically prior to kids, we have this little bit of a burst of energy where people want to be involved. They want to influence change. They want to get into it. And then life happens. And so what we see is that organizations that are giving back to their producer members, that have meaningful workshops, that are providing meaningful opportunities, that are giving actual credibility. So they're generating positions where there's actually some level of authority given, where there's an actual decision-making or ownership piece that goes with it. They will retain those people through the ups and downs of kids and farming challenges and all of those things that hit you in your 30s. They maybe have a reduction in the participation that they have, but you'll see them come back full force in their kind of late 30s to early 40s. That being said, if we take that same group and we offer them token seats where they don't have any meaningful impact on the organization, they're not building any credible skills, they get to a point where you're evaluating different options for your time. And you go, coaching minor hockey actually seems a lot more rewarding than whatever I did here for 3 days. Then you lose those people and they don't come back. And it's very hard to try and motivate someone in their mid to late 40s to come back to an organization that they say, tried that once, it burned me, or it felt like a waste of time. It's very hard to get them re-engaged and re-energized to want to contribute to the sector, to agriculture as a whole. And they're no longer seeing the value in doing that. They say, I farm and I'm just a farmer. And that is the single most damaging line that we have in our industry is, I'm just a farmer. Nobody is just a farmer. Mm. We're business people. We're entrepreneurs. We're like the vast level of knowledge that you have as a primary producer is incredible. And when we build networks where we are giving back to our farmers as well as actively taking in information from them and building an organization that accurately reflects the things that they want and the things that they need, we empower them to not just be a farmer. I'm not just a farmer. I'm a leader. I'm a policy change driver. There's so many things that we have the ability to do with a little bit of research and a little bit of development on our communication vehicles and the messages that we're sending out to really foster that engagement and getting those people back to the table.
And I think part of the reason that I so intuitively believe in your model of leadership and it evokes such an emotional reaction in me is you understand the role that media plays in the social fabric, in our sense of identity, in our sense of community. And where a lot of certainly older leaders just dismiss media as like this thing out there, you recognize it as being central to how we connect and how we do stuff and how we organize. And in that regard, Future Herd is here for you. Anytime you need any help, any support, we got your back. I am absolutely thrilled that you accepted my invitation to come on. And I would like to say, you're welcome to come back at any time. I don't want Future Herd to be like one off and done. I want us to become a kind of leadership culture, right? In which we get the kind of intergenerational, diverse perspective, kind of fostering that sense. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to discuss? Any final thoughts, any subjects that you think are relevant given the various threads we've weaved and ducked and gone into tangents with today?
Honestly, I think we've covered like a pretty vast variety of subject matter. I really enjoy it. I think it just goes back to that people first mentality. And we're so good in ag at adopting innovation and adopting technology. And there's this current rumblings of, oh, AI, this and AI, that. But I think what we need to do is just center that idea that technology is never going to replace relationships.
Yeah.
Technology is never going to replace that connectedness and that interwoven fabric of community and wanting to support one another. What community looks like may change and it may evolve, but at the center of it, it's people-centric and it's all about using people and your relationships that you build to elevate the industry, to elevate your own business, and understanding that those people relationships, those relationships that you build are central for life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your point about I'm just a farmer as kind of a dangerous phrase, you kind of evoke just now the other dangerous phrase that I fear, which is I'm too old to learn, or I'm too busy to learn, because I think that's also kind of central to what you're describing and what we're teasing out. I would, to your other evocation, love to have you back at some point to talk about AI from the media perspective, not so much from the technology perspective, because I think it is also another dynamic that we've discussed today. But we've run way past, and if it wasn't for my ADHD, we can keep going, but I have a million other things I've been neglecting that I need to get to. But Steph, this has been an absolute pleasure. Your ideas around leadership and around people-centric agriculture, organization, policies is revolutionary. So again, I wish you all the success. We got your back. Anytime you need our support, we're there, and we'd love to have you back.
I'd love to come back. So thanks very much for having me.
If you've listened or watched any of our previous episodes, you can tell that I get really excited when I start learning something, and I'm easily infected by other people's passion. And in Steph's case, I could barely contain myself. It is phenomenal to meet leaders who inspire you and make you really think that the future we are all entering is exciting and filled with opportunity. What stayed with me after we wrapped the recording was how grounded Steph is in the human side of agriculture. We spend a lot of time in this sector talking about production, trade, technology, policy, all the systems that surround and enable food production. But Steph kept bringing the conversation back to the people, to the realities farmers are navigating every day, and to the responsibility leaders carry when they speak on behalf of others. There's a quiet honesty in the way she approaches leadership. Not pretending to have every answer, not hiding uncertainty, instead showing up with curiosity, empathy, and a willingness to keep learning, even when the pressures facing the sector are intense. That mindset matters right now. Agriculture is operating in a period of rapid change. Geopolitical shocks, shifting markets, evolving expectations from the public, and a new generation stepping into leadership roles across the country. Conversations like this remind us that the future of the sector isn't just going to be determined by policy or technology. It's going to be shaped by the character of the people willing to lead through that uncertainty. Willing to take risks, willing to step up. And Steph is clearly one of those people. If you enjoyed this episode half as much as I did, please share it with someone in your network who's thinking about the future of food, the future of farming, and the future of this country. And if you know of a leader we should be speaking with, whether they're on the farm, in the boardroom, in policy, in research, we'd love to hear from you. So thanks for listening to The Future Herd, and we'll see you next time.